Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hola, and welcome to a big interview from the vault. Look, all right, no fooling around. We asked our socios, our members, our supporters at patreon.com/GrahamHunter to pick their favourite from season 2 of this long-running and, I have to say, much-loved show. You're about to hear one of the interviews they picked as the best from a selection which included international footballers representing Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Bulgaria, Argentina, England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Here's what I had to say about this one when we recorded during season 2016-2017. The excellence of John Collins' ability in his career was perfectly emblemised by his pretty dramatic move from Celtic to Monaco in 1996, where he'd play alongside a couple of relatively promising youngsters named Thierry Henry and David Trezeguet, whatever happened to them. I went down to Monte Carlo and La Turbie, the training ground, to interview John 20 years ago and saw what I thought were many remarkable things of the Monaco sporting culture. In this big interview, John explains, for example, why it was that those two young French internationalists were asked to carry the kit hamper into the dressing room at most away games during that season just before they won the World Cup so dramatically with their country. During his own time in French football, John underwent something of a technical and tactical revolution and found that that was well within his capability, well within his locker. But his marginal gains approach to self-improvement had started way back in his teens, and he explains it. How else would a skinny kid from Gala Shields get the opportunity to line up alongside George Best in only his second professional game? He tells a wonderful story about how he simply couldn't believe that was going to happen. John still has strong opinions with which I fully agree about the development of young footballers. Here we talk about Jean Tigana, plus, of course, that iconic cheeky wink to camera before Scotland-Brazil, the opening game of the 1998 World Cup in France. Did you think it was to you? He'll tell you why it wasn't. This is a player who was ahead of his time in many ways during his own career, and sadly, because the game has slipped backwards, I think he's still very far ahead of the thinking of most people in modern football, certainly in modern football development. He shouldn't be out of the game. His views should be listened to and applied. And if anybody's got any sense, they'll employ him very soon. How much I enjoyed talking to John Collins for the big interview. Hey, John. I think it's well established that beyond a super athlete and a good footballer, you're a generous man. And the proof of that is, this is the 20th anniversary of the first time you tolerated an interview by me, which was in different, less beautiful surroundings, warmer surroundings. Take us back, if you will, to La Turbie, which is where I think I met you for the first time. And it's a place that impressed me a lot. So before we tell the bigger story of John Collins, the Monaco player,
La Tourbe. Describe where we met and what that meant to you in your working life.
Well, La Tourbe is Monaco's training base, up in the mountains behind Monaco, actually in France. It's cut out of a mountain. Beautiful views, backdrop of the Mediterranean. The most beautiful drive up to a training ground probably in the world.
Yeah.
I came from Barrowfield, and any Scottish person will tell you Barrowfield's not the prettiest drive in the world from Celtic Park to Barrowfield, but it was a wonderful training complex, and for me it was a night and day moving from Scotland to Monaco. So it was a great location, but more important than anything, what goes on top of those pitches is the most important. The work that gets done on the training pitch.
Can I take you to something that I saw? Like, and I am obsessed by little details, but we were obviously a bit nervous, or at least wanting to put on our best show, chat to you, not make a pig's breakfast of it. And we're watching, we're allowed to watch training. That's the first thing as a journalist you go, this is inner sanctum, because in Britain we believe that journalists should be brilliant at writing about football without ever seeing how it happens,
yeah.
Which is just daft. So we get to watch training, and it's stunning. But at the end, I don't know why we were taken into the dressing rooms, maybe just to register with you, where every single player, none of whom knew us, stopped as they're changing or showering or whatever. But as we walked past, every single player, bonjour, say good morning, handshake to these strange foreigners, show of respect. I'd never seen anything. Is that part of that club's culture at the time? Or?
Well, exactly the same thought that I had the first day I walked in. Everybody coming up to me, shaking their hand, bonjour, welcome. And it's something that happens every single day. You go down to the academy in the stadium, we've got all the academy kids. Nobody knows me. Every single one of them walks up, first thing they do is say bonjour. And I think it was something that really surprised me when I came back, and I came back to Everton, and it wasn't part of the daily routine. Some players would just take their coats off, hang up, hardly say a word. But I really appreciated it, made you feel welcome and part of them, and it wasn't just shaking hands for the sake of it. They look you in the eye, and it comes with a smile. So was it part of Monaco's culture or the French culture? I don't know, but certainly at the football club it was something that, to this day, I was there 3 weeks ago watching the training. I was over with the family, and it, same thing, players come up, say bonjour, welcome.
What was the motivation? Let's leave all talk about contracts or Bosmans aside. When you've got that option to go to Monaco, and my memory is at the time that you have plenty of options, Nice not being one of them, what's the motivation to say, I'll choose this?
Well, I was coming at the end of my contract at Celtic. I signed 2 3-year deals. I've seen the first one out, signed a new 3-year deal, and the final year of my contract I'd made the decision that it was time for a new challenge. I was 28 years of age, and I'd been in Scotland playing first team football since I was 17, and I was going to make a move. So, well, my agent phoned me and says Monaco want to fly over and talk. I thought, wow, that sounds exciting. One, French football was a good standard.
True.
Technical. Ball played on the grass, which is the way I like to play it. Monaco, obviously, a beautiful place and a beautiful climate. It appealed to me. I've got to be honest, I didn't know too much about Monaco and the players. Actually, I didn't know any of them.
Mm.
But I knew they were always pushing for the league, top 3-4 clubs in France. And when I went over to talk to them, I liked what Mr. Tagana had to say to me. The first thing I asked the coach, the most important thing at that stage of my career, I wanted to play central midfield. I didn't want to play wide. So before we talked money or contracts or anything, the talk with John Tagana was, where are you going to play me in the team? He pulled out his matchbox, pulled out 10 matches, put his shape of his team up and says, that's where you're going to be playing, in that central zone. Loves young, quick player on the wing outside you who'll suit you, play passes. And that young player turned out to be a great young player, went on to have an amazing career, which was Thierry Henry. So the first thing was, I wanted to go there, but I wanted to play in a position which I felt I enjoyed most, and that was central midfield. So
that was a demand to have more influence in the play, was it?
Yeah, to be, when you play central midfield, you can control the game, you can get it off the back four, and then you feed. And you play wider, you've got to wait on players feeding you, so there can be large periods of the game, long periods of the game, when you don't get a touch of the ball, but you're still making the runs and working hard. And it's an important role in the team, the wide player, don't get me wrong, it's vital. But I just felt at that stage of my career, I wanted to play that central role so I could be involved in the match, in the thick of the action.
One of the things we've learned with the feedback to this is that sadly, not everybody's of my generation, and you're younger than me, but you'd have been of an age to understand who Takana was when you were talking to him. And for those who haven't maybe seen him play, he genuinely, not only was he a great, he was part of one of the great European midfields in that France side that wins the European Championship. And they were genuinely sensational, weren't they?
Yeah, it was Platini, Giresse. I mean, top quality. And they're sort of the idols at the time. They were French idols. When I went across, wherever we went, away from home, it wasn't the players that the supporters were talking or looking for autographs. It was still Jean Tigana. So he was a great player. He played in the midfield zone. So I certainly had a relation with him. When it came to talking tactics and what he wanted from
him. Was he a teacher?
How can I put it politely? He knew what he wanted from his players. He told me he wanted everybody to pass and move and receive the ball and work hard. But he wasn't a coach that worked hours on end on tactics and moving the team about. But I think his biggest asset was selecting players. Not that he signed me, but he signed good players. And he liked giving young players a chance. Which I think was a big thing for him, certainly at Monaco, because we had obviously a budget to buy players, and they often did buy players. But when I was there the first year, he integrated two young players into the first team, Trezeguet and Henry, which takes a bit of doing for a manager to do. But needless to say, those young players did a great job for the team and him. But he was a quiet manager, wasn't a manager that was shouting and bawling and too animated on the pitch. But he gave very simple messages, wanted us to play, go and play. And he had a good group of players there.
It was a sensational group, and I remember going in this interview that you gave me. Remember that the time, like Kenny Dalglish at Newcastle going very well. And you'd drawn them. It was the break in the European trophy, which was the UEFA Cup, and you knew that in March it was Newcastle. And then in England, because there are a lot of people who maybe don't have a wide vision, well, that's an easy draw. Newcastle through. I remember you saying to me, see that kid over there with a long sort of Rastafarian hair? He said, he'll take Newcastle apart. He'll absolutely... People haven't heard about Thierry Henry, but he's... You said... I mean, I think at the time he was 19.
Yeah.
And he'd only had... You know, about 15, 20 starts, tops. And you marked my card and said, this guy's just going to be exceptional.
Yeah, he had lightning pace. He was so athletic. Never had a great left foot. Something he had to work on. Mm. And he did. And he's finishing every day after training. But our forward line was terrific. In front of me, we had a little number 10 called Ali Bernabeu. Fantastic
sensational
player.
Sensational
player.
Did he come
10.
To City in the end?
He came to City, at the end of his career.
Yeah.
Played for Paris and Bordeaux after Monaco as well. And we had a striker the first season, Sonny Anderson, who was a terrific Brazilian. We sold him for fortunes to Barcelona. He didn't do so well at Barcelona, I don't know why, but he came back to Lyon and won title after title in the terrific Lyon team. But he had blistering pace and skill as well. So
Little Victor?
Victor on the right hand side, Ekpeba, the Nigerian winger. So we had lots of talent.
When Thierry Henry comes into the team, is he playing wide or off the stretch?
No, he played wide. He played outside left. Uh-huh. He played out wide of me. Which,
cutting
in on his right foot and bending things in the top corner of the faraway post. But his biggest asset as a young player was his just, one, he was powerful, two, blistering pace, and he was raw. Sometimes he held on to the ball too much, but his pace just frightened to death to defenders. And he was very humble, well mannered, and a hard worker. Came through the academy system, Clairefontaine, well educated, worked hard, didn't have too big an ego. He was calm, always listening to the senior players. I've got a wonderful story I tell. The year we won the title, the rules were an old kit man, he was a 7-year-old, Petit Louis he was called, too old to be a kit man and carrying hampers, but he folded the jerseys. And the rules were, the youngest in the squad carried the hampers off every bus, every plane, wherever we went. And the season they went on to become World Cup winners with France, they carried the hampers on and off the bus without one moan. And always
tries again on me.
Yeah, and when I think back, I think, well, credit to them, but it was the rules in the club. Young boys do the lifting and the carrying, keeps their feet on the ground. Remember where they came from.
This is something that we talk about a lot. Training ground culture in Britain, and Martin on the train here was talking about In the majority of the big continental countries, the way in which it's expected that players maybe have breakfast at training, maybe stay for lunch, that their diets are controlled, but that they either do a little bit of extra work or maybe some gym work, but it's not, which I think the predominant British culture has been, in getting about 15 minutes before training, get stripped, do an hour and a half, get out of there. In the bad old days, maybe to the bookies of the snooker hall or for a bevy. But also this concept over my lifespan has been, if you're a footballer, you get in, you do your training, it's important, and then the rest of the day is yours. Whereas I don't think that in the leading continental, that wouldn't have been your experience.
No, not at all. I think the first thing, the biggest difference when I went to Monaco was Celtic was hard training, pre-season was tough. My first week, we went to a training camp up in the mountains, and I'll never forget it. I was sharing with a young player. He came into the room. We had dinner, arrived at about 7 o'clock, went down for dinner, came up to the room. About 9 o'clock, he went out of the room and came back up with his training kit. And I was like, well, what have you got your training kit for? And he says, oh, you have to go and get it tonight, because we start 7:30 in the morning. We go, before breakfast, we go for a jog in the woods. That's the first session. And I thought he was joking. I thought, serious? 7:30 start, yeah, right. Up at 7 o'clock.
Shine on.
So sure enough, it was true. I had to go down and get my kit. First morning, 7:30 session, up to your room, shower, breakfast, back, 10:30 start, technical session with the ball, working hard till midday, lunch, into your room, siesta, back out for a third session, technical again, 5 o'clock. And for a 10-day training camp, it was training three sessions one day, two sessions the next, three, two, three, two. And in between that, eating well, sleeping well. So after 10 days, it was like, wow, it's equivalent to what I would normally get as 3 weeks training back home. Because the players come train in the morning, go home. So the amount of work we got done in that training camp was incredible. And also at the same time, for me being a new player, it was wonderful. I spent a lot of time with my new teammates, getting to know them. They were getting to know me, and obviously I was working on my French at that time. But it's the same in academies over there. They put a lot of hours on the training pitch. It's not just one session a day, I think. I may be wrong, but most Scottish teams will play on a Saturday. They'll have Sunday off. They'll train Monday, Tuesday. They'll have Wednesday off. They'll train Thursday morning, a little bit on Friday. So for me, the younger players that from the age of 18 to 21 are still developing their game and their technique, they need more sessions, more afternoon sessions to work on their technique. But there's certainly improvements in the way Scotland and Scottish teams are training in the hours, but I think there's still a long way from the
French. It's a philosophical change that's needed, isn't it? I think it's just we have to approach it different mentally.
Well, it's a job. It's a full-time job. It's not, you just don't go in and do an hour and a half session and think, I've done my work, that's me finished. You've got to ask yourself, what else do I need to do? What other work could I do? And it doesn't have to be physical. It might mean I'm going out in the afternoon and I'm going to just work on my right foot, doing passing. Just pinging it 20, 30 yards from a left footer. I see a lot of players that are so one-footed. And one thing that when I'm watching Scottish football, I see he's a left-sided centre-half, he's 20, he's poor, his right foot. I'm like, well, how long has he been at the club? Oh, since he was 10. And I'm like, well, how can he have a poor right foot if he's been in the club system since he was 10 years of age? For me, when that happens, it means there's a flaw in the system. If you've got a player in your system for 10 years, he can't be 20 years of age and have a poor right foot. You've got to work right foot, left foot. And I think maybe that's what the continental clubs, they break it down in France and they do more individual work on the players. And I think that's, we can learn more from that and spend more time on the training pitch.
Take aside your talent and set it just to one side for a minute. I'd imagine the more demanding that the atmosphere was on a daily basis in France, probably the more that helped you. I mean, you're somebody who, grit and determination and self-betterment are just pretty much embedded in your character.
Well, training is always something. I've always loved training. I've always loved pushing myself. From a very young age, it was encouraged from my father. I had a big brother, huge role played in my development as a football player. Why? Because I played with my big brother's friends all through my childhood, from 7 years of age up until about 14. I was playing with big guys. I was never the star in the training pitch or in the streets because they were all bigger and stronger than me. So I've always been pushed. And when I went to Monaco again, I was pushed to another level on the training pitch.
So with the Big Brother, that's pushed to, you want to, you're not left behind, you don't want to be knocked over, you want to show I'm one of the big boys.
Well, it's competitive, but when you play with bigger kids, you can't run past them because you're no faster than them. You can't bump your way around them because you're no stronger than them. Right. So you have to think and use your skill and develop your football brain. So I have to 1-2 it past them. I have to play it right and run past them on the left. Or I have to go forward and then jink backwards, change direction, use my strengths, which is I'm smaller, I'm more nimble. So people talk about street football, small-sided games. That's where you develop your brain and your touch because you're getting thousands of touches and you're making thousands of decisions under pressure, often against bigger players. And it's something that's gone now. Street football won't come back in as it was in the past.
No.
But I've said it before, many people have heard me, we've got to try and replicate that in the academies. And that doesn't mean, and that means moving players up levels, age levels. So
testing them, taking them out of their comfort zone.
Taking them out of their comfort zone, so they're not a big number 9 at under 13 scoring 50 goals because he's bigger, stronger. Because he's not developing.
Yeah.
And I'll say, as soon as you go 3 goals up, as a youth player, you're not developing as a player because it's too easy. The opposition is, there's too much space and it's too easy. So you've got to try and develop your academy teams that they're all playing up. So if you, for example, you're Celtic or Rangers, you don't want to be winning 5-0, 3-0, 6-0. So can you have the under-12s, a lot of the good ones, playing up an age? And for me, that's what street football did to the good football players. They were stretched, playing against bigger, stronger, thinking, making their brain work on that training pitch and getting thousands of touches of the ball. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I think when I break it down, that's what we've got to try and get back to within our academies.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I think players and sometimes coaches, sports science have got a lot to do with it. They sometimes say, oh, you're training too much and rest. And I think a lot of the time I agree with sports science a lot of the time, but when it comes to young boys, I think they should be spending more time with the ball in the afternoons, trained in the morning, they've had their lunch, have a nice rest, back if we've got an indoor gym, or go and play 3v3s, go and get set up little small areas, 4v4s. And people talk about, I go and see big games, 11v11 kids, 12, 13 year olds, some kids hardly getting a kick. What you get in 4v4s is triangles everywhere. You get decisions made constantly, defensive decisions. Where do you go? Moving right, moving left, moving forward, moving backwards. And when you have the ball at your feet, exactly the same. I'm looking right, I'm looking left, and people are coming towards you. Football, some people say it's a simple game, but it's a game that's learned. People are coming towards you all the time. People are going away from you different times. There's a ball involved, so the brain's working constantly.
A lot of decisions to make.
A lot of decisions, a lot of distances to be read. And the more they have of small, high-tempo games at a young age, the more their brain and their touch is developing. And that's where we've fallen behind European countries in Scotland. Because, technically, we're not where we should be, and tactically, because we're not technically where we should be, our tactics have evolved to such an extent we're not playing technical, skillful, gifted football from the back through the goalkeeper, because people are saying, oh, they're getting caught in the ball because they've no technique. so let's just kick up the park. So basically, when you say that, you're giving up. You're saying, well, we're not playing football anymore. We're playing a different sport. We're playing a game that's half rugby, half football. So it's got to be a radical change. And people say, players don't grow on trees. Players are developed. Developed by a system and by coaches, doing the right things on a daily basis. And the reason we're not developing and getting to World Cups and European Champions is it's no bad luck. It's nothing to do with luck. It's all to do with the system's broken.
What was it like playing with Barthez at the back? Because I need to point out that your time at Monaco was fabulous. Title, late stage semi-final of the UEFA Cup, semi-final of the Champions League as well. It was an elite group. Starting at the back, Fabian Barthez.
Barthez was a good football player, again, with his feet. A small goalkeeper, but he had a terrific spring. He could jump very high, and he had great confidence. He was one of those guys that was never stressed, just cool, calm, came to training. He was always in his jeans, torn jeans and a T-shirt, dead relaxed. But he was a happy guy on the training pitch, had a terrific attitude. Didn't like most goalkeepers, didn't like conceding. But he was a footballing goalkeeper. Again, that's what I liked about him. He passed, he had a terrific left foot, pinged it. And I was no surprise when he got a big move to Manchester as well. Did he do well at Manchester? I think he did. Had a decent career at Manchester. Wasn't probably the standard of Edwin van der Sar. But he was a good goalkeeper. And I go into my right back, Sanyol.
Tough guy.
Good football player, had a great career at Bayern Munich. But again, he was a technically gifted football player. He was so confident in the ball, liked to get forward. Manu Petit.
Just a joy to watch.
In my Monaco team, he was often played, sometimes he played centre-half, sometimes he played left-back, sometimes he played central-mid, but he was more often in the back line than he was in midfield. But he went on to Arsenal.
Nearly to Rangers, Walter Smith came down to...
That's right, I think that was a year before. Before I went, Rangers were sniffing and interested him. A good all-round football player, did the simple things very well, nice left foot, won tackles and kept the ball, and had a terrific career.
We sat with Michael Carrick in this series and we were asking him to describe, I don't know why, because he was talking about liking the battles with Arsenal. He was talking about Petit and he said he had this technique of he'd win it, turn, see a space. He said he'd play a little golf shot with his left foot to set over Mars, backspin on the ball, over whoever's coming out, over Mars bombing through, just did this lovely distribution.
Terrific left foot. It's a good description he did. He chipped it with a backspin. He was always comfortable on it. And his left foot. He was all left foot. Again, fairly quiet lad, just got on with his work.
About 2004, I was down in Monte Carlo after your old team beat Chelsea, Claudio Ranieri's side. And it was a big night because Chelsea had been leading. It looked perfect. Ranieri changed things. Monaco got late goals, 3-1. They won on the final. And that night in the town, there was this fella up on a table in the bar dancing with two beautiful women. Royal fella. The prince up on the table giving it, oh, you beauty. Prince Rainier's son, Grace Kelly's boy. I know you know him very well. I've interviewed him before. Sportsman.
Yeah.
Olympic sportsman. His days are gone now. But what was it like with the old... Did you get on with the prince?
Yeah, but he was very attached to the football team. And people often surprised when I say this. He used to regularly come down to the dressing room before the game and after the game, wishing us all the very best. He was travelled to away games in Europe every time. He was always in the stands supporting us. He'd be up at the training ground watching training. No, he took a big part in the club for a number of years. Obviously his father was still alive when we won the title, and we had a wonderful party in the Café de Paris. Him and his father was there, so great memories. But it's changed days now, unfortunately, at Monaco. He's taken a bit of a back. He's still at the games, but the new Russian majority shareholders are in now.
Now, I wouldn't be allowed home by Mrs. H if I didn't ask you, why did you wink at the camera?
Everybody asked me that question, and I'll tell you the story.
Sorry.
My wife was at the game, my father was at the game, my two girls, young, two, four-year-olds, were with Granny, and I promised them, watch Daddy on the telly, and I'll give you a nice big wink on the television. So that's who the wink was for, the two girls.
But did you have any idea about what might be happening in the sort of football female population?
No, at the next day, and everybody was saying, "What? Who are you winking to? What were you winking for?" looked like you were showing off and trying to be cool.
That's not what people say to me. My mum, who's 79, oh, he's so good looking. It was John Collins' sex symbol.
Trust me, it wasn't to the ladies, it was to my two little princesses who were sitting with their granny.
Lucky girls. Was Scotland a good adventure for you? I think there must be some regrets, because you were part of our last good group, and maybe a qualification from a group stage was within our grasp.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah, I think 98 we were disappointed not to qualify. When the group was drawn, Morocco, Norway and Brazil, we felt we could get that second place.
Mm.
And I still think we should have. I think we had the players to get it.
What went wrong?
I think against Norway we should have won. We were the better team against Norway, 1-1. Brazil, we were never expected to beat them, but we put up a great show.
And there was nothing left in the game.
And there was not a lot in it. We gave a really good account of ourselves. In the last game, we had to go for it. Morocco, we needed a win in the last game.
Did the red card condition things a bit?
What time was it? You tell me.
I'd say it was at 1-0, I think.
Yeah. I haven't looked back in the game. I'm not one for looking back and realising defeats and bad moments. Probably should have, and you'll probably learn from your defeats more than you do from your victories. My recollection of the game was we were pushing. They scored the goal. We were pushing for an equaliser. They counter-attacked us again. And again, 2-0, we had to go for it. And again, they broke. There was regrets, we never qualified, bitter disappointment. But when you look back now, we'd love to be in that position now, wouldn't we? Getting to tournaments and being part of the main event, the Tartan Army. No matter what anybody says, the Tartan Army brighten up the World Cups.
There's a big
champions.
Smile on your face now as you say it. It's true, isn't it?
Because my greatest memory of Scotland is going to the Stade de France, sitting on the bus from the hotel to the stadium. It was a long way. And just seeing Scotland fans at the side of the roads, all the way nearly, scarves, and then you get closer to the stadium, and it just the numbers build up, and the yellow strip, the Brazilians singing and dancing with the Scottish fans, bagpipes. I think, wow. I mean, it was memorable. And then going, obviously, to the stadium and lining up before the game, playing against the mighty Brazil, Ronaldo, and who else was there? Rivaldo, Roberto Carlos, Cafu.
Beto.
So there was a lot of quality in that team. But, you know, we were organised, we were disciplined under Craig, and we were hard to beat. But we never played with fear. And I think that was one of the things. We just went. We had a go.
Look, character in your group, I think.
Yeah, I think when you look back now with Tom Boyd and Burley, Henry, myself and Lambo, middle of the park, we were comfortable on the ball. Darren Jackson played. Gordon Dury playing.
We'd have been about that time.
We had good legs at the top of the pitch as well. I mean, Kevin Gallagher, sharp, chased everything. So we gave it everything, and it'd be nice if in the future we get back. Being part of it, international matches, packed Hamdens, getting to finals, getting to European champions. It's a pinnacle for any player. The pinnacle is standing in that middle of that turf at Hampden, facing the main stand, your father, your mother, your friends in there watching it, the national anthem blasting out. It doesn't get any better than that. It doesn't get any higher than that. No matter what anybody says, nothing beats that feeling. You're picked for your country, number one. All the football players, you're representing your country. It's a great feeling. Certainly was for me. And I had it for about maybe a 10-year period, near enough, which is a long time. And at the time, obviously, media and fans expected, wanted more of us when we got to the finals. But when you look back now, we did not too bad.
The intensity of your desire to better yourself and to show others that they can do it too, that's a defining trait of every conversation I've ever had with you. What? How do you encapsulate that for somebody who's listening to this now and thinking, well, I don't know if I can do it, I don't know if I can achieve it, I don't know if I've got enough? What do you explain from your experience about how to improve yourself?
I always go back to when I was 15. I went up to Dundee United on a trial with a great manager, Jim McLean, and they were probably the best team for developing young players at that time. So I went up on trial, and I was still playing for Hutchison Vale in Edinburgh at the time. Three of my teammates had signed to go full time there, so I was hoping to be the fourth. So I went in the week's trial, and the feedback was, no, you've not quite got it, we'll keep an eye on you. In those days, There was no mobile phones, so I was driving home, getting the bus home from Dundee to Gala Shields. A long, lonely journey home, and going back to school the next day to tell my buddies that I'll be staying on at school, I've been knocked back. But on that journey home, I thought, I'm going to prove them wrong. They said I was too small, maybe a little bit weak. So that was in November. Middle of December, I got a phone call from Hibs to come in on a trial, Pat Stanton at Hibs. I had a week's training and it was with the first team. And I think I did well. I was just 9 stone, little kid for Gala. At the end of the week, Pat came in and says, phone your dad, I'd like your dad to come up tomorrow and have a chat. My dad came up and Pat Stanton says to my dad, we're going to offer him a 2-year apprenticeship, and I can promise you, Mr. Collins, age means nothing to me. When John's good enough, ready, he'll be in the team. And I signed, I left school in January, just before my 16th birthday. 31st of January is my birthday. So I went full time, started getting the bus up for Gala Shields at 7 o'clock in the morning, getting home at 7 at night, and running from St Andrews bus station down to Easter Road, back up to get the bus home. And I continued playing for my boys' club for the 6 months. I played for the reserves on the Wednesday night, trained every day like a beast. I was in the gym trying to build my 9 stone frame up. Season finished. Never forget, my dad says, you don't stop training. You're going back pre-season to be fittest at that training ground. So I trained all closed season, came back for pre-season. All the first team boys are telling me, hey, slow down, stay in the group, who you try to fuel. And then my dad says, don't ever stick with a group, push away from them, don't be happy with their standards, set your own. Washing the stands Friday night, first pre-season friendly match of the season, Manchester City against Hibs. I'm cleaning the seats with Paul Kane, Mickey Weir up the stand because they've been all dusty throughout the summer, wiping the seats down. Shout for Pat Stanton with cigar, hey, come down to my office. And the manager, I'd just been at the club for 6 months playing my boys club, he took me into his office, he smoked his cigar, he says, is your dad coming to the game tonight? I says, no, my dad only comes to watch me and he's a Celtic supporter. He says, oh, is that right, son? Looked at me with kind of a little smile on his face. He says, you better phone him and tell him to come because you're going to play tonight. Left his office, went back up to clean the seats, and the boy said, I thought he was joking. The boy says, what did the manager say? He says, I'm playing tonight. I'm like, eh? I said, I don't know if he was joking. I went back down and asked him. And he says, you're playing tonight, phone your dad.
Mr. Stanton, is it true? Am I genuine?
I couldn't believe it. And sure enough, it was true to his word. A manager, nothing to do with age, trained well, he seen something in me, put me in the team. That was Friday night. Did fairly well, wide left. Played Jackie McNamara's testimonial on the Sunday, 2 days later against Newcastle United. Beardsley and all them. And George Best was guesting for Hibs. So my second game, who am I sitting next to? In the dressing room getting changed, the legend George Best. He's playing inside left, I'm playing outside left, getting passes from him, playing 1-2s, and I'm like, wow. It was like a dream come true. But I wasn't ready for the first team. I was just a little, tiny little lad. But Pat Stanton was a smart guy. That whole season started, I never played in the first team. I went back to the reserves. And the following season, I was in the first team debut at Aberdeen. Pittodrie, we lost a few late goals, unlucky. But a manager, again, that's when I'm a manager, I love giving young players an opportunity because, for the grace of God, I might not have had the career I had if it wasn't for a brave manager saying, you know what? Because all the first team boys wanted to play against Manchester City. People think it's just a friendly, but the first game of the season, all the first team players wanted, and there's this little kid, Harley, had a training session with the first team in the first team. So Pat Stanton, I owe him so much on Hibs, of course, because that was my first club. But he fed me that little bit, and that drove me on. But it all came maybe from Jim McLean knocking me back. And it's a great story to tell, lots of, because young players get knockbacks. Life's about knockbacks all the time. Barriers all around you. You come to a barrier, what do? Somebody says you're not good enough, you say, okay. Or do you think, you know what, I'm going to prove him wrong, prove me right. I'm going to go round the barrier, over the bar, I'm going to find a way of doing it. It's a message I tell all young players. It's not where you start, it's where you go. Whether it's in the gym or out in shooting practice, how many you score at shooting with your right foot, left foot, how many free kicks you can put in the top corner, bottom corner. Your numbers are important, and you've got to set yourself targets. never be happy where you are. Always try and get better and push yourself, push yourself. And that's what I did. I did for 19 years. I was fortunate. I had coaches that gave me a chance. I worked my socks off. I had very few injuries, which is a lot has got to do with good luck, good fortune, but also good preparation. I turned up for training, having a good night's sleep and being ready and alert on the training pitch, so I never got any, picked up many injuries in the training pitch. And it's all about preparation, putting the work in on the training pitch. And people talk about having the will to win. The will to win in a match, the kicks off, is important. It's very important. But what is absolutely vital is the training. What you do is vital. If you don't do the proper training during the week, you don't get the performance on the Saturday. So that's where we've got to get into players' mind. Because in Scotland, I see the game's kicked off and everybody's running about, giving 100%, running, chasing. But they've got to do that training Monday to Friday, morning, afternoon, how they're sleeping, eating. You've got to get that into the mindset. How do they better with the right foot, left foot, control, speed, endurance, stronger core, direct free kicks. It's about details and about pushing the boundary. But it all comes back down to, again, is quality coaching. Players don't grow on trees. They're developed with good coaches and good habits on the training pitch.
The sooner that that knowledge, that passion, that ability to develop is back somewhere, hopefully in Scottish football, the better forever is the recipient of your attitude and knowledge. A privilege and a pleasure, as expected. Thank you very much. What a great career.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true. Graham Hunter. And Back Page. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Here endeth the lesson.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.